My name's John Nunns. I'm a long-time commercial equity barrister, mediator and arbitrator. Michael inherited me when he took over the list. And like my colleagues, Terry and Peter, I do work in the probate and wills area. It's my pleasure to welcome you. 60 registrants, good attendance as usual to Michael's educational programs, and to introduce you to my colleagues, Peter Pascoe and Terry Constantino, who are also commercial equity barristers and mediators, and who will present the papers they've written to you. I'll introduce you first to Peter. Peter's been a barrister for about 24 years, and over that time he's developed a specialist practice in the equity, trust, probate, wills, testator's family maintenance, or Part 4 as it's now called, to my clerk's surprise, areas. He also works in property law and superannuation, and you'll find about 6 excellent papers on the Greens List website that Peter has written in those areas. This year he also represented a successful appellant in the Court of Appeal in Perpetual Trustee Victoria and Barnes 2012 VSCA 77. That was an application for approval of variation of a trust. His leader in the Court of Appeal is no longer available to take briefs because she is now Her Honour in the Supreme Court, Her Honour Justice McMillan. Peter's paper deals with 4 specific areas of the problems of will making: problems of shifting executorship, where, for example, you might have a priest of a church or a firm of solicitors. Second area is substantial changes to prior will-making patterns, which may raise suspicions of circumstances, including suspicion of undue influence. The third area of problems to look for in Peter's paper is ambiguous drafting. And the fourth area is drafting in ignorance of statutory provisions. And the specific example that he will deal with, I think it's Section 45 of the Wills Act, the provision which provides for the substitution of issue. I welcome Peter to deliver his paper to you.
Thank you, John, and good morning. Despite what John said, I'm really here as the warm-up act for my co-presenter. We had a discussion yesterday over a cup of coffee, or in her case, a cup of Earl Grey, and we decided on the order of play, and I was delegated to go first. I'm actually pretty amazed that I'm here on time, and yes, this is the right venue. It's such an early start, and Michael isn't here, but I'll pass it on through Brett. Why does he keep misplacing my standing order that I don't get out of bed this early unless I'm catching an international flight? Anyway, you've all done well to be here at the same time and the same place. What we're doing this morning is focusing firstly on some aspects of will drafting and will making. A little bit of esoterica, really, to commence the paper. Namely, as John has just mentioned, this so-called rule or principle of the shifting executorship. What I've done in doing the paper is to roam far and wide, as you'll see. We're dealing with a couple of South Australian cases and a Queensland case and shooting at home to Victoria. But in roaming far and wide, I've come across this particular South Australian case, and the principle of shifting executorship, or the so-called rule, has always been one that's just there on the back tip of your mind that you sometimes think about when you see clauses appointing firms of solicitors as executors and the like, and you quickly scan and go on to some other part of the will that you're told is more of a problem. We'll come to those aspects relating to solicitors as executors later, but the particular matter was brought firmly to our attention in Chaumiac's case because as the particular solicitor who drew the will had in that case, and as you may well have in your own practices, you can have a client who has a very strong religious affiliation or a strong affiliation to some other cause, and that is a dominant feature of their will-making instructions. And it's when you get into those sort of areas and outside the mainstream of family relationships that these sorts of issues can occur. And so, as I repeat, this was a will drawn by a solicitor, and we have it set out there on the first of the pages of my paper. So there was a revocation clause, which is again indicative of a well-drafted will, but clause two starts to create the problem because there is an appointment of the priest in charge for the time being, that phrase being bolded, of the Ukrainian Catholic Church of Wavell in South Australia to be the sole executor and trustee. Now, I've given the hint and the game away by focusing and bolding the phrase for the time being, so that's our key to what will be discussed later in my summary of the judgment. But how the matter came to court is, of course, the ever-vigilant registrar, both in Adelaide and in Victoria, was perusing the will and the application for the grant and thought, whoa, this is something a little out of the ordinary. In the dim recesses of his or her mind, the principle of executorship and shifting executorship probably reared its ugly head, and he or she did the prudent thing and referred the matter into court for a determination on the question of whether or not the appointment was valid. So what I've done is to slightly reformulate that particular issue for the court, because the court had to spend much of its time in discussing the so-called rule against shifting executorship. So I asked the question, what does it really mean? Because I suspect that we all think we probably know it, and if called upon and pressed hard, we would probably get something near the answer, but let's just try and work our way through so that we come to a proper understanding of it. Although they weren't the facts of the particular case, which I footnoted at one, just to assist in our understanding of the meaning of the phrase, consider these options. You've got Priest X being the priest in charge at the time of the execution of the will. You've got Priest Y, who's in charge at the date of the deceased's death. You've got Priest Z, who is actually in charge at the time when the application for the grant is ready to be put to the registrar. And then you could have a situation, because I'm envisaging a pretty quick turnover, that priests hold office for a period of no longer than 12 months. And of course, in doing that, I'm sort of making a cross-reference to the executor's year in some direct or indirect way. So you start to see there's a lot of ambiguity as to what the phrase for the time being might exactly mean. It's an obvious problem. But ambiguity alone, or uncertainty of meaning, doesn't constitute shifting executorship. And so if we come down to try and define the phrase, what we actually refer to is an executorship that is limited in time during which the office holder holds office. And upon ceasing to hold office, there is an automatic cessation and an automatic replacement as executor by the new office holder. So that really underpins the use of the word shifting in the phrase shifting executorship. Now, the formal recitation of the rule is to the effect that if found to be the case in a particular will, the court would determine that such an appointment was invalid and would refuse to make the grant with that sort of a clause and that potential appointed office holder. But Chomiak's case causes us to actually ask the question, does the rule exist? Because in a quite a learned judgment, Justice Gray in the South Australian Supreme Court reviewed the various English texts and the relevant cases. And to cut that particular quote that appears on the second page down, it really is a point of saying, I think this is a Victorian thing. I can't find a reference to it anywhere else. That's doing his honour an injustice, but it's sort of the nub of what he said. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But what was then discussed was a number of authorities drawn from a range of areas of the law on the meaning of the phrase for the time being. And again, giving credit where it's due, His Honour, after reviewing a number of authorities, then did us the singular pleasure of summarising it and making it easier for us. And so I've adapted his summary there, and he really discerns the following propositions about the meaning of the phrase for the time being. The first of the summary points is really summed up in the word, it's all about the future. A person holding office for the time being may be a person with office which occurs in the future. Then what he does is to go into some of the particular facts of this case, because Father Chuck, if I've got the pronunciation correctly, was the priest at the time of the deceased's death, and there was a Father Gorbignac, who was the priest in charge at the time of the application for the grant. So that aspect of future point of time is part of the key to understanding the first summary point. The second is that it refers to an event which will occur eventually, and that when it does, a person has an office on the happening of that event, fulfills the condition. Now, the third point is the, and this is drawn again from other case law in other contexts, the right of the person to fulfil the condition is the person or persons who are able to commence an action, in this case, making an application for a grant of probate in respect of the will. So you've got an aspect of the future giving rise to an event that will occur eventually, and then the right of a person to fulfil a condition, him then being, or her then, she then being, the office holder at the particular time. Now, what His Honour then did at the paragraphs that I've referred to, 37 to 49, I think that should be, there's a typo there, delete the zero, he referred to, in particular, the decision in Queensland of the Chief Justice McCrossan in the case of Ree Khan, which I footnoted. And the particular footnote summarises that particular case, and again, you'll get the flavour of the principle and its application, especially in church contexts. So he had there an appointment of an executor as the secretary for the time being of the Mohammedan church at Logan's Road. And the secretary at the date when the will was made was not in evidence, but at the date of death, the secretary was Kay. But then shortly afterwards, two other joint secretaries were appointed and they sought a grant. And in that case, what His Honour, the Chief Justice, did was to grant probate to those joint secretaries, limited for so long as they should hold office. And the commentators, such as Hutley, say that in Ree Khan, Chief Justice McCrossan really ditched the doctrine of the shifting executorship, ignored it, and was prepared to make, in effect, an appointment that was limited in time, namely, for so long as the joint secretaries held their office. So that the counsel for the applicant for the grant in the particular case that we're now coming back to, in Chomiak's case, submitted that Chief Justice McCrossan's approach was correct. That's the way to go. Don't go and emphasise the points of uncertainty. Just make the appointment. And His Honour said, this submission has merit. A testator can't speculate as to who at the date of his or her death will hold office, but a testator may want a particular office holder to be appointed to the office of executor. And he then goes on to talk about the particular priests that were involved, but then says, to my mind, the testator's intentions are tolerably clear. She intended to confer rights on the priest in charge who holds office when duties of an executor are to be performed. And that is His Honour's interpretation of the meaning of that particular troublesome phrase. He then went on to by way of obiter, under the bold heading of the principles of construction, say, quite baldly, look, it's not necessary for me to consider it from a construction point of view, but if I do, having regard to the armchair principles, then I'm satisfied that the deceased had the intention to have the applicant hold the office of executor. And there was more of his judgment in support of that particular conclusion. So that what I've said is that having regard to the above decision, and especially that review by His Honour of the authorities and bringing firmly to our attention that this seems to be a uniquely Victorian thing, seem to have more to say about it than many, we could perhaps safely conclude that the principle of shifting executorship, if it exists, doesn't apply in South Australia and perhaps not in Queensland, given Ree Khan. So what about Victoria? And it's here that we come back to the aspect of this particular principle or rule insofar as it applies to appointment of solicitors or firms of solicitors as executors. And that was the decision of Justice O'Brien in the Supreme Court in Ree Milton. And I'm extracting aspects of Ree Milton from the judgment of His Honour Justice Gray in Chomiak's case. So that's a convenient summary point. And what you had in that particular case was an appointment clause relating to the firm of Sly and Weigel, as it was, that later became Deacon Graham James. And the appointment was of the two most senior partners at the time of my death. Now, just emphasise there, in using the phrase at the time of my death, you're taking out of play that difficulty caused by the phrase for the time being. So you're well on the way to getting things right. As I said, just going back to it, you're appointing the two most senior partners at that time of the firm of Sly and Weigel. The solicitor's address is stated, and the normal clauses then follow on. Now, the registrar in that case, again, was the source of the matter coming before the court because he served a requisition upon the plaintiffs requiring evidence of the fact that Sly and Weigel and Deacons Graham James are one and the same, having noted, obviously, the amalgamation that had taken place. And there was a subsidiary problem of uncertainty, which is where we're picking up the particular aspects of the judgment. Now, His Honour Justice O'Brien in that case stated the law as he understood it, particularly in Victoria, by saying that the appointment of executors is invalid if the testator intended to constitute a shifting executorship, as happened in the will of Jonathan Binns Weir. And in that case, and you can see how the flavour of the problem starts to arise, because in Weir's case, the testator appointed the manager for the time being of a particular company as the executor, and the court refused to grant probate because, as we know, managers can change. That was the genesis of the problem, and His Honour also referred to re-Anchortel. Interestingly, geographically moving then back to South Australia, His Honour Justice O'Brien spoke of the case of re-Yearwood, and that was the decision of Justice Lego that may be known to practitioners who've sort of had to express a view and do a little bit of reading in this particular area, because in that case, the will appointed the partners at the date of her death in a named firm, and then went on to say, or the firm in which or which at that date has succeeded to and carried on its practice. And that was an attempt based on an author's note in one of the English law journals as to what might have been a suitable phrase to cope with the changing nature of legal practice. And in this particular case of re-Yearwood, there was a dissolution of the name firm. And summarising the matter quite quickly, His Honour Justice Lego in that case found that there were in fact no successor firms. They had all split. The partners had gone here, there and everywhere. And the clause therefore failed. Going back to Justice O'Brien, having dealt with that particular case, His Honour said it was clearly distinguishable as the evidence that had come before the court following the registrar's requisition revealed that the name Sly and Weigel, the firm name, was changed to Deacon Graham James on 15 September 1995, more than 3 years before the deceased died, but presumably to his knowledge, and the plaintiffs were the two senior partners of all the partners of Sly and Weigel at the date of the deceased's death. And to help matters along and to arrive at a favourable decision, the business name of Sly and Weigel was still registered, and the plaintiffs were the registered proprietors of that firm and the firm name. So that assisted, and that might be something to keep in mind if similar clauses were finding their way into wills that you were the author of, because so often we find when we're reviewing successions of firms. I remember one in recent times in relation to an accounting practice. The former names, the registered business names, were no longer in existence, and yet there was an allegation in the pleading that the current defendant was a successor firm to previous firms. So, to wrap up this particular area, I'd say that we don't have the luxury of casting off the doctrine of shifting executorship in Victoria. We still do need to keep it as one of our points of note. Slight red alert when we're dealing with unusual situations, differently constituted clients. So what I've said is, under the practice note, prudence dictates that you don't succumb to your client's suggestion that when she's leaving the whole of her real and personal estate to a fund to endow the Alfred Hospital, she thinks it's a good idea to appoint as her executive trustee the general counsel for the time being of the Alfred Hospital or its successor organisation. Bill O'Shea would probably not be happy for me to make that statement, but I think prudence would dictate that you do not succumb to that particular suggestion of the client. You can just see that is a clear invitation for the registrar to refer the matter into court and for counsel to be briefed to argue the matter. All right, let's park that one and move on. Our second aspect is the vigilant solicitor and the vigilant solicitor in the role of will drafter. This particular matter again came to my attention by combing far and wide and coming across another South Australian case, Carney and Hall. And what we need to do to understand this particular point is to start off with an appreciation of the area of the law as to the essential validity of a will that's referred to knowledge and approval and the associated topic of suspicious circumstances. Now, you'll be aware of these sorts of general headings because No doubt you've set out grounds of objection for caveats on many occasions, and you go through and you chant the usual mantra: testator lacked testamentary capacity, testator didn't know and approve the contents of his and her will, and by God, there was undue influence as well. Tick, 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 they're the three. Right, okay, we've got the grounds. That'll buy us some time, and now we'll go and get some evidence and see how far we go down that particular path. All right, so what you've got here is that aspect that relates to knowledge and approval. And again, as you'd know, this all ties in with your affidavits of due execution. So there, a little bit of theory and practice coming together. The law as to knowledge and approval is one which relates to or is based on the decision of Justice Isaac, former Governor General, in a case called Nock and Austin. And I set that out in my footnote. And note that my co-presenter, Terry, is going to discuss a related matter of the solicitor beneficiary, but this one aspect of knowledge and approval deserves mention because, as I've looked for and found, it is not a matter that is taken up in our Bible here in Victoria, Wills Probate and Administration Service. Those learned authors, Ken Collins, Richard Phillips and Carolyn Spark, under the general editorship of Richard Bowden. But in the learned English text, Williams, Mortimer and Sonnex, you have this particular statement: a radical departure from testamentary dispositions long adhered to requires explanation, especially if the persons in whose favour the change is made possess great influence and authority with the deceased and originates and conducts the whole transaction. And such facts may give rise to a strong suspicion that the change was not the result of the free volition of the deceased, but that suspicion may be dissipated by proof of a change of circumstances since the earlier wills. So what we have is the vigilant solicitor being vigilant when there is a substantial change in the will instructions from a prior pattern of will making. Now, Carney and Hall examines that particular proposition and does so in a situation where there was found on the facts to be family pressure and persuasion, and the particular change was a change from a long-standing pattern where she had only ever given a pecuniary legacy to her husband and then divided the matter equally between her two children. And what she did by way of a change in her final will was to bring them all in as one-third takers of the residuary estate. Now, His Honour, in that case, I think it was Justice White, looked very, very carefully at the evidence, and I footnoted some of the findings of His Honour in relation to the solicitors who were involved in the drafting of the will, and they came up smelling roses. And that's the desired outcome whenever your conduct is likely to be in question. So what I say there in terms of practice notes is carefully review a client's prior will-making history and ensure that he/she knows and approves significant changes and executes a will as a free and capable testator. I know you will say this is making will-making so onerous, we get very little for it. Is there a further burden being placed on us? And the answer I would say is yes. Be very careful of significant changes from prior pattern of will-making. The way in which the matter came before the court there was through an allegation that there was a suspicion of undue influence. You remember I referred to the family pressure and evidence to that effect, so that we've got a suspicion of undue influence as the ground that's being put forward. It is not undue influence. There is no claim of undue influence. There is a claim of a suspicion of undue influence. That gives you a whole lesser burden of proof to try and establish, and it's one to keep in mind when we're looking to draw our grounds of objection. And I note that in a footnote, and it's something that comes very clearly out of a judgment. Time's pressing, let me move on very quickly. What I've done with ambiguous drafting, because as will makers, will drafters, we're always looking to get the text right to avoid ambiguity and uncertainty and later costly exercises with Order 54 proceedings. But quite simply, in Thompson and Downs' case, after a second marriage, the testator had made a will in which he'd used the phrase, all my children. He had six natural children and his second wife had three children from her marriage, who, as the relationships evolved post-second marriage, all got on famously. So when the testator came to die, there was an issue, well, what's the meaning of the phrase, all my children, in these circumstances? The stepchildren said, well, surely we're included. We've had a great relationship with the old man, been a successful second marriage. Unfortunately, that wasn't the construction adopted by His Honour, using, again, the armchair principle with which we're all familiar. And I set out the particular text of the will and the evidence that was able to form the basis of His Honour's decision. One point I'd just make very quickly in passing is that the evidence about the good relationship post the second marriage wasn't relevant evidence. It wasn't able to be taken into account in a determination as to the meaning of the phrase because it was all post the event. You really got to look at the relevant evidence at the time the testator is sitting in his or her armchair and what she knows or what as a reasonable person he or she ought to know. So the practice note that I've offered is take careful instructions about the natural step and adopted children of the testator, and even with other aspects now with technology and in vitro fertilisation and the like, it's just potentially very, very broad ambit indeed. But take those proper instructions and then you'll avoid, hopefully, Order 54 proceedings. Again, moving quickly to keep with the tight timelines, coming back to Victoria and His Honour Justice Habersberger, we have a very interesting case of Kavanagh and Reardon that picks up the what we'll call the statutory substitution of issue that's affected by Section 45 of the Wills Act. Now, what you had in that case was a specific devise of real estate and some supplementary provisions relating to proceeds of sale. And then that particular devise rather was to one particular son. Then you had a residuary clause that included both children and then had a substitution of issue clause. So what you had was a situation where the son predeceased the testator and it became a vexed question as to what was to be done with the specific devise of the property. Did that lapse into residue or was there substitution of issue by virtue of Section 45 so that the children of the deceased son alone would take the particular devise of the real property? Now, His Honour, Justice Habersberger, made it very clear that there had been conflicting advice from counsel on the issue. So you might say, well, you know, that's not uncommon and perhaps as a generalisation it's not. But there are some particular features of this case that make that conflicting advice quite worrisome because the conflicting advice, as we read later into the judgment, may well have been the result of conflicting views of Professor Ford and the full court of the Supreme Court, as it then was, in a case called Bussell. Bassett, I'm sorry. The text of my paper makes those conflicting views quite clear, but in a sense, it really reduces to this. Professor Ford says that if you want to avoid statutory substitution of issue and express a contrary intention, which is what Section 45 of the Wills Act is all about, you should actually use the phrase, this is an expression of contrary intention pursuant to Section 45 of the Wills Act. to avoid the statutory substitution. Now, that wasn't done in the particular case. The clause in relation to the devise of the Northcote property was silent. And His Honour said expressly, I am bound by the full court decision in Bassett. And I footnoted the facts of Bassett, and basically what you had in that particular case was a will that said, in the event of one of two named beneficiaries predeceasing the testator, the surviving beneficiary was to take. So I give it to X and Y, but if one of them predeceases, then the survivor takes. Now, Ree Bassett in the full court said that was an expression of contrary intention. You didn't have to expressly state this is an expression of contrary intention pursuant to what was then Section 31 of the Wills Act to avoid statutory substitution of issue. So you've got this clear conflict. And remember, Professor Ford was a world authority in relation to not only company law, but equity. And when you have a judge of the Supreme Court, such as Justice Habersberger, who was a student of Professor Ford, by the way, saying, look, Harry Ford was Harry Ford, he's an icon, and I feel bound, however, by the full court decision in Bassett, you know you've got a potential problem, even for the future. Because what I say as a practice note and prudence is, just to be sure, it might be of great assistance to say expressly, this is an expression of contrary intention. So if it's Section 45 and the statutory substitution of issue doesn't come into play. Because when you look at the judgment, you, and having read it, you think, well, why wasn't this taken on appeal? Some very clear views, even although you've got a full court saying one thing, that was a full court some time ago. Those members of the court are no longer on the bench. You just get that sense when you know the judge and you read what he says that perhaps prudence would dictate that you try and take a future court of appeal, high court, out of play if the estate is big enough. All right, I've well and truly gone over time. John's been very patient. Thank you very much. Okay.